Well, we are back, obviously, and this is a year that we are in Sunday school devoting to the topic of prophecy. And so what we're going to do, we laid a foundation in the fall for just sort of the big picture of prophecy, how to understand the different prophetic views, and now we're going to take the winter and spring to trace different topics within prophecy. So we're going to trace different themes, prophetic themes that start at the beginning and work its way, how the Bible unveils its prophetic picture, in other words, using certain topics and themes. So each Sunday we're going to pick a different theme prophetically or symbolically and then trace it through the Bible, which is really interesting, I hope you think. Now, as I go through this, as usual, if you have any thoughts or questions, comments, just raise your hand and we'll stop, and because I don't have a separate discussion time for this one. So what we're going to look at today is the prophetic theme of the waters or the seas. As the Bible is unfolded and unveiled, the seas have an important place as far as prophetically unveiling God's plan of redemption. So a little background, you'll see here, the Israelites, obviously, were not a seafaring people. They were a land people. It wasn't until almost Solomon's time that they even knew anything about boats, or it was just too far away, and they were an agricultural people. So to them, the sea was a great mystery. They weren't like the Phoenicians who actually lived on the sea. And so the Mediterranean to them represented a formidable threat and fear, because they knew about the fierce storms. They would hear stories about people dying in the storms often. They knew they were creatures in the deep that they had never seen before. They had just heard there were whales, sharks, whatever they were, they heard about them. But, of course, in their own experience, they never came across one. And so for the Israelites, the sea was an extremely frightening place. Now, not only for the Israelites, but for all the nations, the sea represented great evil. And so the surrounding nations considered the gods of the sea the evil gods. They were the ones that brought destruction. They were the bad gods. Because you go out to sea, you get lost. You go out to sea, you're shipwrecked, or something bad often happens out in the sea. It's this uncontrollable, chaotic force. And so if you look at the mythology of the other nations, for example, the Canaanites, Baal was the Canaanites' god. And the reason he was the Canaanites' god is because he defeated Yam, who was the god of the sea. And so Baal was their hero because he was stronger than the god of the sea. For the Babylonians, Marduk was their god. Their temples, their main god was Marduk. And so, but Marduk was their god because he defeated who? The god of the sea, Tiamat. And so, I don't know if you're familiar with the Babylonian creation story, but you have Tiamat was the main god. I mean, there were many little gods, but he was the main god. He was the god of the sea. And so it was a very chaotic god. It was just sort of a watery mass of a world with evil. And none of the other gods could overcome Tiamat until Marduk, that almost sounds like Marmaduke, huh? Until Marduk rose up, and he controlled the four winds. And so he took the four winds and he defeated Tiamat in a great battle. And when he defeated Tiamat, he cut his carcass in half, and that became the heavens and the earth in Babylonian mythology. And so it's interesting that all the nations considered the sea the place of chaos and evil and danger to the people. And so the Bible utilizes this view of the sea, but it demythologizes it or mythicizes it. So it takes out, obviously, the myths associated with it, but the general idea of the sea being a place of chaos and evil, the Bible in its prophetic literature and its in general literature picks up on and uses, because that was the greatest fear for the Israelite. I mean, if the one place were uncomfortable, it would be the sea. And so in Genesis 1, now notice how we're going to trace the sea throughout the Bible. In Genesis 1, you have the waters, but the waters are already there. Notice the waters aren't created in Genesis 1. It just says the waters are over the face of the earth, right? We're not even told, well, didn't God create the waters? Well, of course he did. But the picture is that the waters, again, represent what is keeping God's people, his image bearers, from having a place to live. God has to do something to these waters for his image bearers to be able to walk and move and breathe and live. And so what does God do? He divides the waters, doesn't he? He separates the waters. It almost sounds like the Babylonian, right? Separating the God into two. But he separates the waters. But notice there's no myth anymore because there are no other gods. There's only one God. He's not fighting any gods. The water does not represent a god in the Bible because there is only one God. But he takes that image of the waters being a place that keeps God, that keeps God's people from their place. So God divides the waters, and he orders the waters not to pass its limits. In other words, he has control over the waters, and he says, you stay there so my people can live on dry land. Somebody look at Proverbs 8:29. And so God separates the waters, and then he makes a decree. The waters shall not again overflow the earth. Now, that raises some questions on the flood being universal or local, but I'll leave that to you. We've talked about that in other venues. But God controls the waters so they will not, again, there will be dry land. And so the point of the sea, as it's introduced in Genesis, is God overcomes already the enemies of God's people, the waters, and he overcomes it by the word of his mouth. It's really distinct from all the other creation accounts where you have different gods battling. In the true account, you only have one God simply speaking. So it would really be set apart from the other creation accounts that would be familiar to the Israelites. But what the Lord picks up on and uses is still the image and the fear of water as being the enemy of God's people. That's why it's not listed as part of creation. It's simply listed as something that needs to be taken care of in order for God's image bearers to have a place. Any questions on that first point? So there's more theology in Genesis 1 than you realize. You see what I'm saying? There's more what we call biblical theology. There's more there than simply an account of how things were made. It's written in a certain way to provoke certain images that will be picked up on in the rest of Scripture. And so when we come to the flood, Genesis 6 through 8, what we have is a decreation. In other words, if you read Genesis 7:18, it's a reversal of Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, the waters divide, don't they? And what happens in Genesis 7? The waters come back and they don't divide anymore. I mean, I'll argue another time. It is a local flood where humankind lived in the Mesopotamian Valley. But still, you have the waters returning as sort of a decreation. It's just the opposite of what happened in Genesis 1. It's the end. It's a picture of the end, isn't it? God created all these creatures, and now it all sort of closes in on them as the waters return. Now go to Genesis 9:1. And again, remember, the subject of biblical theology is the unfolding of the history of redemption from Genesis to Revelation, using certain themes that will continue to be picked up on. So Genesis 9:1, someone read that. Ooh, that's not the right one. I'm sorry, it was 8:1. Put 8 in your notes there, if you don't mind, if you have a pen. Someone read 8:1. So think of that. God made a wind blow over the earth and the water subsided. What should that remind you of already? Genesis 1. Genesis 1, because God's Spirit hovered over the waters in Genesis 1, 2. Now, any Hebrew scholars here? What's the Hebrew word for spirit?
Ruach.
Ruach. What's the Hebrew word for wind?
Ruach.
Ruach. It's the same word. So what you have is a picture of God's Spirit again over the waters, separating the waters. So God's people, this time Noah and his family, have a place to live. The Jews would have picked up on that theme that you have, especially in the Hebrew, because you really have the same word. The Spirit is like the wind, right? And so, again, you have the Spirit of God or the wind of God over the waters. Now it's the flood, separating the waters again, dividing them. And so God's people can live. Now, of course, throughout Genesis where it says you have the waters below and the waters above. What are the waters below? I mean, if you're right there in the flood, you have waters below subsiding. That would just be, yeah, the floodwaters, the rivers, the whatever has filled up from on the ground, the waters above is the rain, right? So you have the rain subsiding and then the water begin to evaporate and drain below. That's the phrase, the waters below and the waters above. But again, you have a separation of the two by the wind or the Spirit of God. Follow these themes now as we go to point three, the waters and the Red Sea. God again divides the waters, doesn't he? And he divides the water for what reason? So the Israelites, God's people, his new creation in a sense, his people will have dry land to live on. What does that sound like? Genesis 1. And so Exodus 14 harkens you back to Genesis 1 and Genesis 9. God has already divided the waters twice, hasn't he? Creation, the flood, and now the Exodus, right? The Exodus event. God again divides the waters. What do the waters represent in the Red Sea and Exodus for the Israelites? If God doesn't divide the waters, what do those waters represent? Death, right? Because they can't cross it, and who's coming? The Egyptians are coming with their chariots. And so the waters become what? The enemy. That's their enemy. If those waters don't divide, this barrier will kill us, right? We're trapped. So again, the waters represent a force of evil, a force that's against God's people coming unto what God had promised. And so God again has to separate the waters. Now how many times have you seen God dividing the waters by the time we get to Exodus? Three times. Follow the theme. Kids, you know what they used to say? Follow the bouncing ball. Remember that? They don't say that anymore, do they? Follow the same theme that throughout the Bible. So you come to Joshua. Where do God's people need to be in Joshua? Where are they supposed to be? Where is their destiny? Canaan. What's keeping them from Canaan? The Jordan River. That's not a river you can wade across, especially certain times of the year. It will kill you if you try to cross it. So what does the Jordan River represent for God's people? Yeah, a barrier that separates them from what God has. It's an enemy force in a sense. They cannot be in God's presence because God's land is Canaan, right? God said, that is my land. They cannot be there with God if they can't get through these waters. So what does God do to the Jordan River? He separates the waters. Now how many times have we seen this theme? Four times, right? Now God separates the waters again, and what happens? God's people are at the place God had for them. It's like Genesis 1 all over again, isn't it? God has image bearers. He's going to create them, but he needs a place for them to live, so he has to separate the waters. Red Sea, the Red Sea is death. By the way, for the Egyptians, what was the Red Sea? Death, right? It's a place of death and chaos as the waters overflow. And so this theme of the waters always being the enemy, this chaotic force that God has to overcome in order for us to be with him, to be in the place where he wants us to be in his presence, that theme continues on throughout the Bible. Now, in the book of Psalms, the psalmist, mostly David, picks up on this theme again. And so look at, for example, Psalm, why don't you turn to 69:3 and the other 93:3-4. So David calls out for God to save him from the waters. Is he speaking literally or figuratively? Figuratively. David was not out on the sea, right? He's in Israel. So what do the waters picture for David? Trouble, death, enemies, anything that's keeping him from trusting the Lord, or any danger is pictured now as the sea. That same theme. And then Psalm 93:3-4. Someone read that. So what are the waves of the sea picturing there? Something good or something bad? Read it again. Look at it. Psalm 93:3. Is he saying something good about the seas, or is it representing something bad to him? Something bad, right? He's saying, Lord, help me. You need to be stronger than the seas because they're so powerful. Are you following me? You have blank faces. I don't know if it's... Is it because it's morning? The waters have overcome your minds. Verse 3, the floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring, mightier than the thunders of many waters. Is he saying life is great? No, he's saying it's turmoil, it's danger. But Lord, you are mightier than the seas. And so now go over to Psalm 65. The seas then represent that which is dangerous for God's people. And oftentimes in the Psalms, it's simply a picture of the nation seeking to destroy Israel. And so look at... Psalm 65, 6 and 7. Someone read that.
We'll start at 5.
Okay.
By awesome deeds and the tumult of the peoples.
So the roaring of the waves is what? The tumult of what peoples? The Gentile nations seeking to destroy them. And so when the Israelite looked around and they heard that Babylon was coming, or Assyria or Egypt, they said, Lord, the waves are beginning to roar again. And so, Lord, you need to do something. The seas are coming. The waves are coming. And notice even in verse 7, it actually explains the poetry. It's the tumults of the peoples. The peoples are the Gentiles. And so, again, the seas represent what? Danger, chaos. That which will keep God's people from being in God's presence. They're coming to kill us. Yes?
Coastlands.
Coastlands is another word for Gentiles or Gentile nations, because that's where the Gentiles lived, along the coasts. So often, you know, the word of God will go to the coastlands, to the Gentiles, is what that means. And so let's look at the sea in Isaiah. In Isaiah, creation is described as God defeating the sea monster, Rahab. Rahab is not the Rahab you think of as that woman in Joshua. That's different Rahab. But the word Rahab, whatever it came from, was a very negative term. So it was used to picture really bad things. And it came to picture Egypt. So there are some verses you'll read in Isaiah, for example, that'll say, God will destroy Rahab. And I've had people say, I thought Ahab was a believer. Why is Ghost? Well, not that Rahab, but it came to picture Egypt, because Egypt became the most dangerous. But here Rahab simply pictures a sea monster. Somebody read that. Isaiah 51, 9 and 10. So doesn't that sound familiar? God cuts up Rahab to create us. Doesn't that sound like anything we've just talked about? What else does it sound like? Cutting up something to bring us about? Okay, what else? The Babylonian story, right? Cutting up Tiamat. In other words, God often poetically uses the nation's understanding but takes the myth out of them, because it's only God who does it by his word. But remember, we're dealing with symbolic or figurative language, poetic language. And so creation is God defeating the sea monster. God defeating that which is most scary in the sea. And then God's enemies throughout Isaiah are likened to the seas, the roaring of the seas. Isaiah 17:12. Who's there? You see, we go to the beach now, and we sit there, and we're overlooking the cliffs, and we have the waves come in, and what to us, that's very beautiful, right? Because we live today, it really doesn't pose much danger. Our boats are pretty large, and we don't think if we're going to go out on a boat, we're going to die, right? So we look at the sea and the waves with very positive connotations, but they didn't. In those days, when they saw the roaring waves in the horizon in the sea, what are they thinking back in 3000 BC or 2000 BC? They're thinking death and danger, the unknown, the most scary thing in existence are the seas. And they didn't have the type of boats that could really, you know, boats, you know, bad storm came and you're dead, right? Or at least shipwrecked. How many times was Paul shipwrecked? At least three that he told about. And that's much later, obviously. That's in the New Testament times. And so the sea represented the scariest part of the universe. Scariest part of the world was the seas. And that's why here, God's enemies are likened to the raging seas. Now, when we come to the New Testament, that theme still continues with Christ and the sea. Because in Mark chapter 4, they're on a different sea, right? What sea? The Sea of Galilee, and they're afraid again. Because why? There's a great storm. Now we think, okay, a storm. Well, in those days, if you're on a little canoe-type boat and a big storm comes, it's a good way to die, right? You can't control it. And so they're scared to death. And what does Christ do? He speaks a word and calms the sea. The raging waters calm. What should that have invoked in the disciples if they knew their Old Testaments? This is God. This is like Exodus, isn't it? This is like creation. This is God speaking a word in the seas. The most dangerous element to God's people have been calmed. And he just spoke it. He didn't even ask God to do it as a prophet would. He just spoke. And he controls the seas. Jehovah controls the seas, right? Yes. Yes, that's a good point. That he, again, it's a reference to him being the God of creation and the Exodus. Because how did he divide the sea in Exodus? A strong wind blew all day. Right, but in this case, he calms it. So here is God controlling nature, the wind, ultimately to control the sea so God's people can live, right? And with Jesus right there. So the theme of the sea being the evil place that will destroy God's people returns. Christ shows he's Jehovah of the Old Testament who always calmed the sea for God's people, especially back in Genesis chapter 1. Now, when we come to Revelation, this theme ends, doesn't it? Obviously, Revelation is the last book, right? So we have the beast, the greatest enemy of God's people, and the false prophet. Where do they arise from? The sea. Revelation 13:1. Now, I've had people who don't know anything about the Old Testament say, why the sea? Why does the sea get a bad rap? And I'll say, you need to read your Old Testament. Because that is one of the most common themes. So we should not be surprised that the enemies of God's people arise from where? The sea. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea. That theme continues in prophetic literature. 17:1, you have the same thing. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated where? On many waters." He's seated on the sea. What's that picturing? Hopefully you're not taking that literally, like, right? He has a little chair that floats. What's the picture? He's seated where? What's the sea?
It's unstable.
The place of destruction of God's people. That's the place of God's enemies. The realm of evil. The realm of chaos for God's people. That's where the ruler of the sea is. By the way, even in Greek mythology, Poseidon, not a very friendly god, is he? God of the sea. You're familiar with the Odyssey. You know, Odysseus does one thing wrong, and what does Poseidon do? Yeah, one breath, and he's 21 years out from seeing his wife again. He just got a little angry, and that was it.
The Little Mermaid said all that.
The Little Mermaid. A cultural icon. Not Homer. Homer Simpson. Okay. So you're not the Downton Abbey person. You're the Better Call Saul person. Yeah, I got that. All right. So given that whole theme that we've seen throughout the Bible, you should not be too confused or surprised with that confusing verse to so many, Revelation 21:1. Which, someone read that, please. As it describes the new heaven and earth, how does it describe it?
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more.
Should you wonder at all what's going on there? You know, and I've had a lot of Christians say to me, "I like the sea. I don't get it. I like the oceans. Why won't there be any oceans?" And I'll say, you're missing the whole picture that's been developed through the whole Bible up to this point. What does the sea represent? So what is the new heavens and earth? What is the picture here? No more what? No more evil. No more enemies of God's people. Nothing keeping them from God permanently. No more threats. Yeah, it's not mean there won't be a literal ocean. It's what the sea pictures throughout the entire Bible, culminating in the new heavens and earth. We do have one sea that remains, though, which is interesting. And it's 4:6 in Revelation. He sees a picture of heaven, and before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal. A crystal sea. What kind of sea is that?
Very calm.
Very calm and peaceful, safe, transparent. It's just the opposite of the roaring seas of evil. Again, this is symbolism, right? And so you could say that the whole gospel is presented throughout the Bible with this symbolism of the sea. What was the sea to you that kept you from knowing God? What was your sea? Your sin nature, Satan, death, right? You deserve judgment. Death was coming. These were the great enemies. Could you overcome these enemies? You were slaves to sin, weren't you? What did God do? Through the gospel, he divided the waters, right? So you could live with him forever. The waters picturing that which kept you from God. He took care of your sin. And he took care of Satan on the cross, right? And his claim over you. And he saved you from the waters. So you could say the whole gospel is pictured with one theme, the seas and what God does with the seas throughout the Bible. Now that's prophecy, right? And you don't need any charts for it. No timelines. Yeah, good. All right, thoughts or questions?
No numbers.
No predictions. Don't have to talk about Iraq or Russia or... It's a good question. Some have suggested that baptism is also a being saved from the waters of judgment. I think I could go there. Yeah. So if someone should ever say to you, what is your view of prophecy? What do you believe about prophecy? You could say, let me tell you about the seas. Let me tell you how it's all fulfilled in the new heavens and earth through Christ. It starts in Genesis. No, you don't have to go there. But any other thoughts or questions? So this is kind of what we're going to do in Sunday school. We're going to take a theme like that, and we're going to trace it and see how the Bible continues these themes all the way to the end. And they all revolve around the work of Christ, don't they? Yes, Mike. Yeah, it would probably be stretching it. And that's a good point, though. We always have to be careful that we don't stretch themes beyond their biblical intent, which is easy to do. It's not like every time you see the water, it's bad. And that would be where maybe where baptism doesn't fit in. Because in baptism, water has a very positive connotation, doesn't it? It's the washing away of our sins. So you have to be careful. It's a good question to ask. Where else is this theme? But then you have to look at the context. Is water really being pictured here as something evil or negative? Or is it just water? Which oftentimes it can just be water, yes? Right. And the Peter passage, which talks about the flood as a baptism, and they're being saved from the waters of judgment, which would go back to what Sue was suggesting. So, yeah, I think I could go there. I think that would be a connection. I mean, if anything else, doesn't it enable you to be more in awe of God that we have one book with one theme, one story, with all these different writers that continue the same theme because the Holy Spirit wrote it, right? And it's really amazing that way. Mark? You mean Satan uses the seas as something evil? Yeah, I haven't thought of it that way. I don't know. It's a good question. You just have to understand that in those days, your family and friends would go out on that water and never come back. And that was common. So whatever was out there was the most evil, scary thing you could imagine in this world. And all you'd sometimes get is stories about some awful storms or monsters. Yes?
Well, I think throughout these, though, it's not just like a cup of water or a drink of water. It's the seas.
Right.
It's not water, water as an element for us.
Yeah, it's not water as a substance. It's the seas or the raging rivers, like in the Jordan River or the Red Sea, the raging sea.
Elemental weather of some kind. Or, huge body.
Pardon? Say that again? Yeah, that would probably be a stretch because that's just water as a substance that we drink. And Terry's right. That's why I said the seas, not or the waters, not just the substance water, yeah. But you're good. You're asking the right questions because what you're doing in your mind is you're making connections with the rest of the Bible. And that's, now you're being good biblical scholars. You're thinking it through. Yes, Sue? Still waters. Yeah, see, there you go. Now every time you hear waters, you're going to start, okay, does that connect? Anything else? You got it? You ready? You ready to lead your own prophecy conference on the waters? 20 minutes and you're done. See, it'll be real easy. Coming to the pit. All right, let's take a break then.